Good afternoon and welcome. It's an honor and a privilege to introduce our speakers and moderate this session. I'm not sure you know how fortunate we are to have these three leaders among our representatives. When I first got involved in politics and government 40 years ago, lobbying Congress on behalf of my then employer, my then boss made a comment that, because I was so naive, amazed me. He said that in Congress, just like everywhere else, cream rises to the top. I had thought that Congress, being such an exalted place, all its members must be like the Lake Wobegon children, above average. I learned from firsthand experience that they're not. There are some real duds, and there are some real superstars. And you are ill-served when you are represented by one of these duds, and you are extremely well-served when you are represented by superstars. These three gentlemen are all superstars, as evidenced by the fact that they all hold or have held major leadership positions. First, on my immediate left, Senator Cree Deeds. Cree represents all of Charlottesville and much of Albemarle. He served in the General Assembly since 1992 and was his Democratic Party's nominee for Attorney General in 2005 and Governor in 2009. Cree serves on three important committees in the Senate: Courts of Justice, Privileges and Elections, and Transportation. He also chairs the Joint Subcommittee seeking to improve our mental health laws and practices. Next, in the center, Republican Delegate Steve Landis. Steve's district is principally in Augusta County, but also includes Western Albemarle County. Steve has served in the House since 1996. He currently chairs the Education Committee and is vice chair of the House's Money Committee, the Appropriations Committee. He's also a member of the key Rules and Privileges and Elections Committees, and for his efforts to promote jobs and economic growth. In 2016, he was named Legislator of the Year by the Virginia Chamber of Commerce and the Virginia Retail Merchants Association. Next, Delegate David Toscano. David represents all of Charlottesville and much of Albemarle as well. He served in the General Assembly since 2006, and before that was on the Charlottesville City Council for 12 years. In the House, David has shown his leadership by having been chosen repeatedly as his Democratic Party's leader. He serves on three major committees also: Courts of Justice, Transportation, and Rules. Please give a warm welcome to Cree, Steve, and David. David always has a PowerPoint, so we'll start with him. In terms of questions, there will be a lengthy question and answer session. We're soliciting questions in writing. There will be people circulating with cards and pens for you to take and write your question.
Okay, well, all right, thank you very much. It's great to be here with my colleagues today, and hopefully we'll have a little fun, learn a little something, and impart a little knowledge. And, you know, I'm thinking about what's going on in Washington, D.C., and I was thinking about your comments, Terry, and all I can say is by the time this is all over with, I hope you will conclude that I am not a dud. Okay, that out of the way. So every year I come with a PowerPoint. You know, sometimes they think that all it is an effort for me to suck up all of their time so they don't have to say anything. But we'll have commentary on the PowerPoint by both of these gentlemen, I hope, as we go through it. They'll just interrupt me. So I'm going to go on. Okay, Jim. You know, admittedly, this is my spin. I didn't converse with these guys before I did it. But here we go, senior statesman. And Jim has told me how to operate this thing, and I'm supposed to do this, right? It says blue, it's supposed to work, and it doesn't work.
No, so, you have to point it at the machine.
Oh, I got to point at that. Okay. Is it sticking? It's beeping. Jim, it's beeping.
Yeah, the old-fashioned one.
Okay, you want to do that?
Mix high tech with low tech.
Just so you know, I've got some materials in the back. If you're interested in reading anything I write, or you can sign up by my website. I actually do write things that are policy-oriented for anybody who's interested. It's not all politics. So I call this Legislating in the Shadow of Richmond. As you well know, we have three Democrats at the top of the executive branch, but we do have some issues with the General Assembly as a whole. The Senate is pretty much 50-50 Democratic and Republican. The House, of course, is two-thirds Republican and one-third Democratic. We're going to change that this fall. So this is a picture of the General Assembly building. Come down and visit us. It's a good experience, and you get to find out how the sausage really is made. Now, there's some good things going on in Virginia and nationally. We've got 82 consecutive months of job creation through March of 2017. Thank you very much. And we'll have to see what happens after March. But the good news is that in Virginia, we're doing some things right to create jobs. Since Governor McAuliffe took office, there have been almost 900 projects placed in put in place. Unemployment's dropped from 5.4% to 3.9%. Over 185,000 jobs are projected to be created by these initiatives, and over $15 billion in revenue projected in capital investment. That's not to say things are all hunky-dory. We've got some challenges I'm sure Steve's going to talk about in terms of our bond ratings and making sure that they stay in place. And we have inequality, a lot of inequality in Virginia. The recovery in Virginia has been, it hasn't been as great in some parts of the state as in other parts. We do pretty well around here. If you go to Southwest Virginia, people are really hurting still on the south side. Inequality is a nice chart that nobody can understand, but suffice it to say, it's not getting any better. We probably have more inequality in this country now than we had at any time since the beginning of the 20th century. It's still the economy, stupid, right? We are all working to try to build this new Virginia economy, and we're trying to put things in place in the budget and legislation to make sure that happens, because we cannot rely on the federal government. It's not clear that they will deliver on their promises. And when you take a look at cuts in federal spending as are projected potentially, it's going to hurt Virginia, and it's going to hurt the monies coming into our treasury that helps fund schools and other things that we consider important. When we got there in January 2017, we had a deal with a $1.5 billion budget shortfall brought on largely by the implications of sequestration at the federal level, and we had to deal with that shortfall. But magically, we were able to deal with it. And as a result, we had a budget that we passed that created raises for law enforcement and state employees, put some more money in mental health, and addressed the shortfall with a tax amnesty program. And this is the big one. Half of the shortfall is made up by grabbing money out of the rainy day fund. This is our savings account for times when things are tough. But, you know, you're going to have to replace that money. And so even though this year we're able to take some of this money to use it to balance the budget, you know, you're going to have to figure out ways to grow the economy and grow revenue so we're not in a position where we have to cut services at some point in the future. And, you know, when you take a look at some of the proposals that are out there for tax cuts, and both the Democratic governor candidates and the Republican candidate also are proposing tax cuts, you got to take a look at that in light of this, which means if you have a tax cut, you're going to have to find the money somewhere. So take a look at those proposals with that in mind. Higher education, we did reduce some of the proposed cuts to universities. We still have some pretty severe problems with tuition increases, and they're detailed in that paper that I wrote back there in case anybody wants to look at that. K through 12, teachers got a raise. We still lag behind the national average, and we really still haven't recovered from the 2007 recession in terms of our investment in K through 12 education. We have our moments, though. This is in the House. The Senate doesn't have any fun. The Senate doesn't have any fun at all. These are things that are happening in the House. Well, the first thing we did is, for those people who want to wear pink out in the forest to hunt, they can now wear blaze pink instead of orange. Actually, the Senate did pass that bill, too.
Bill, I voted against it. I voted no because I thought it was an insult to women. It was an insult to everybody to think that more people will buy hunting licenses just so they can have a fashion show in the woods.
See, that's what,
if somebody wants to hunt, they can hunt.
That's what I like, a senator who stands on principle.
But the lady hunters like it, though.
The lady hunters like it. Well, you know, this is something you can tell people about, okay?
Yeah.
We did designate George Washington's rye whiskey as the official state spirit. Last year we had the state rock, remember that?
Yeah, but interestingly, the spirit that was rated the best flavored in the country is produced in Nelson County this year. It was produced, won a contest in Nelson County, or in the country. It's the new scotch that the Virginia Distillery Company down below Livingston is producing.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, this just shows that the Senate spends a lot more time reading and studying these bills. I never realized that. I still voted for this.
Yeah, I voted for it.
As you did, too. So we're both on the hook for this. Now, the big news, of course, is that we did designate the Song of the Mountains as the official state television series. Has anybody seen the Song of the Mountains?
Okay, it's a great show. They produce it in the theater in Marion, Virginia. It's an old theater. It's not like the Paramount, except it's not exactly like the Paramount. But every Saturday afternoon on your PBS show will present something that comes from the Song of the Mountain program that's produced in Marion, Virginia. And it's a good show.
We don't know that she's ever appeared on the Song of the Mountains. And we don't know if the guy in the pink outfit is out there looking for her, but okay. Then we had this bill. This never got to the Senate. This is the Speaker's bill that had to do with guns, dogs running at large across people's property. It failed on a 49-48 vote. 49-47.
Matt Ferris, the delegate from Campbell County, gave an unbelievable speech on this bill. And I just died laughing when I watched it later that evening. And I think I had a bill before some subcommittee that he was on Monday morning. And I just said, listen, man, you got to campaign for me next time. You got to write all my material.
Right.
It was so good.
So anyway, yeah, you check that out. Just put in Matt Ferris, it'll pull up the speech. All right, so let's get serious here. There were some things that we got done that actually do make a difference in people's lives. We did a lot to try to combat the influence of opioids on Virginians. I mean, this is a stunning statistic that more Virginians die every year from overdoses than from car accidents. So we passed several bills having to do with prescriptions being electronically transmitted to pharmacies so somebody couldn't walk off with a prescription, use it for themselves even though they didn't need it, except they needed it because they were addicted. A couple others allowing community organizations to possess and disperse naloxone, which is a drug people use to get off of the addiction, and a clean syringe program that would help for HIV and hepatitis C. So we're trying to do some things there. That was, with all the controversy, this was an activity that it was very much bipartisan. Okay, so then there's some other successes. Having to do with things as diverse as having Airbnb registration occur. If you are renting out your place, you have to register your place with the local government so they can keep track of who's renting out their places. I had a bill on address confidentiality. This is a program run out of the Attorney General's office to protect people who are victims of sexual assault or stalking so that their assailants can't find out where they live. And so we had a little bill on that. This little bill has to do, it's a lawyer's bill, So, and they can talk about their bills too.
The one there that's labeled judicial discretion when suspending driver's license, you all have probably read that in Virginia that the hundreds of thousands of people whose driver's licenses are suspended, a lot of them for just failure to pay fines, being suspended essentially because they're poor or because they don't have the money. Well, the law also requires with every drug conviction, you have a driver's license suspension for 6 months, whether or not you were under the influence of drugs when you were driving a car when you were caught. So what we passed this year is allow judges to more discretion with respect to those people who are convicted of possession of marijuana. Unless it's driver-related, unless they're using it while they're driving, the judge doesn't have to suspend the driver's license. He can just give them an additional, 500 hours of community service or something. It's something significant. But it recognizes the fact, I think, that if people don't have driver's licenses, they can't work. They can't produce income to take care of their responsibilities.
And I think Steve brought along a bunch of these session highlights, and that you should take those. That's a good summary of what's happened that's successful and what failed. All right. Mental health legislation. Cream will probably talk about that at some point. Failures, no Medicaid expansion. That's my humble opinion, no Medicaid expansion. Somebody's going to ask about ACA. We'll hold that till later. I like this cartoon. That's just me. No student debt relief, no attention to distracted driving, no increase in minimum wage, no gun safety bills passed this year. And then, of course, we have this. So what do you see? Gerrymandering. Here we go. This is three districts around Virginia that are really weirdly drawn. We didn't get a bill through on redistricting, and we'll talk about that. This is what happens when you let one party control redistricting. Why states matters. Chambers held by party between 2009 and 2016. Watch the map. You see what is starting to turn? Red. Things changed pretty dramatically in state houses over that period of time. We can talk about that too. Vetoes, lots of them. The governor was—he was sustained on every veto he put in. We can talk about these. There are a lot of them. 111 vetoes, 114 vetoes. 41
this year.
Yeah, there's a lot. So we can talk about any of these as you want, and that's for later. Primaries, June 13th, of course. Don't forget to vote, and then November 7th. And I know it's fast, but these guys have lots of things to say too. So thank you.
Steve.
Well, that's a hard act to follow, but I'll try. First of all, let me thank the senior statesman for inviting us once again. It's good to be with you all, and I always appreciate the chance for your all's questions, so I'm going to try to be as quick as possible. David mentioned, if you want, there is a session highlights. I brought some of these hard copies for you. I'm kind of old-fashioned. I don't have a PowerPoint, so I'm just going to go through my notes and try to give you an update from the things that I saw that were impactful. David mentioned the budget. We do spend a lot of time on the state budget. Our budget's $107 billion for the biennium, and we were able to reduce debt by about $61 million. It provides for about a $35 million cash reserve that the bond rating agencies really wanted us to look at doing from the standpoint of making sure that we replace the rainy day fund and that David mentioned, or the revenue stabilization fund, as we call it. And we did all that without expanding fees or any tax increases, but we did provide that 3% increase for state police and also other state employees and faculty, the 2% increase for state-supported local employees, and a 2% increase for teachers, but that begins in February of 2018. The budget, actually, that the House and Senate adopted actually exceeded the governor's K-12 spending by about $18 million and provides for more flexibility for our local school systems, which I think is important. Let me real quickly say that one of the concerns that David pointed out is we have gotten notification from
one of the bond rating agencies. And the bond rating agencies are the folks that review state budgets and determine whether we're a good bet from the standpoint of paying back our debts. And states issue debt for capital projects and also for authorities and entities that the state backs certain debt for construction projects. And it's good to have a bond rating agency because you get the best rate when you're going out to the market and actually trying to borrow money for those projects from a state or a municipal standpoint. I don't know how they do it in Washington because they print money. That's a whole different process. But we don't print money in the state. We have to balance our budget, and we have to be cognizant of the fact that these bond rating agencies are looking at what we do. And just recently we got notification, even after we did this reserve that they actually asked for, and they knew that we were utilizing the rainy day fund and saying you all are kind of be put on a watch list. So the new budget that Governor McAuliffe, his last budget that he'll introduce, and the new incoming governor and the General Assembly are going to have to make sure we take that seriously and look at that very carefully. But that's going to be a challenge going into the next session for those that are elected or reelected. Now, let me real quickly talk about some legislation I was involved in, and I was grateful that these things were passed, both the House and Senate, and signed by the governor. One of the things that I've worked on the last number of years is trying to do more to spark our economy. And even with the figures that David gave, which are all good, accurate information about where job numbers are and the like, our economy is only growing at about 2%. 2 or 3% annually. Historically, Virginia's economy coming out of a recession has grown 6 or 8%. So when you look at cost of living increases, when you look at the just cost of doing business, we're not keeping up with a lot of those additional costs. And that's the other challenge that the next General Assembly and the next governor will have as well. So what we've been trying to do in working with Governor McAuliffe is in a bipartisan way, is trying to find ways to really help spark the economy. One of those initiatives was the program called Go Virginia. I actually serve on the state board, the local regional council for here. I believe that's Region 9 has been formed. There's a regional council in the Valley, Region 8. They're looking for new and unique ways to really start business clusters or provide assistance for businesses or areas of the economy that we're not, you know, really pushing at this point. So those plans are going to be coming back up this fall, and then they will be given some planning money to start really that process. All the regions across the state will also be getting kind of benchmark information on what their job numbers are, what their current economy is doing. And then the state board will help then make decisions related to where those funds that the state has set aside for that program. So I'm looking forward to that. In addition to that, there's a couple pieces of legislation. I had two bills dealing with small businesses. One of the things that I've tried to do over the years is try to look at our programs that I don't think we do enough related to small business job growth and really helping small businesses, because about 75% of growth in any economy comes from small business and small business activity. So I had House Bill 1968 and 1969 that dealt with two funds or programs that help small businesses. And what we did is we tried to tweak those programs that are already in place and try to bring the definition of what a small business is down to a reasonable level. Right now, the state has defined small businesses as employing 250 or less individuals. Well, if you've got 250 employees, you're becoming pretty much a larger business. So what we did is brought that number down to 50. So we're really targeting those funds towards truly small businesses, and they'll be able to access those programs. One's the Small Business Investment Fund that small businesses can access, and the other is the Small Business Job Grant Fund. Albemarle County actually is trying to revitalize part of the urban ring, especially areas that are blighted or have seen a downturn in economic activity. And what they brought to me, which I thought was a great idea, and these guys helped with as well, was House Bill 1970, which gives counties the same authority that cities have had for a number of years, and that is to create economic revitalization zones so that they can provide specific incentives at a local level and also give special consideration to a developer or a business that may be coming in to redevelop a certain area like a shopping center or a part of the county that is blighted or having problems from the standpoint of businesses and business activity. So that was a good reform. Another area, and I'm very thankful to the governor for signing this because we've worked on this for 2 years, and he actually vetoed the bill last year but was good enough to sign it this year. And we worked with the administration and worked with stakeholder groups, and that was the passage of House Bill 2053 that creates direct primary care agreements. One of the things that a number of us have been trying to do is look at how we can assist, provide additional options for our healthcare system, at least from a state standpoint. And what direct primary care agreements will allow, with some additional amendments that the governor proposed for disclosure and making sure that consumers really know what they're getting into from the standpoint of these agreements, is a simple contract between your doctor and you, or it could be a doctor or practice and a small business that may want to provide this as a benefit to their employees, so that if you have a health savings account or if you have a high deductible health insurance plan, which a lot of individuals do, young people especially, that you can get primary care basically for a more reasonable cost or price outside of insurance. This isn't insurance. It's basically, it's kind of going back to the old days when you actually went to your doctor and you paid them directly for your appointment. And what this does is just set that for whatever you agree to pay, the doctor will provide that specific service. And it's for primary care. It's, in other words, regular office visits. It could be for you and your family. And so that's going to be in the works, and that'll have to be developed after the law takes effect July 1. We think that will be something that would be beneficial. Had a number of bills that dealt with education, and I chair the Education Committee, so I get a chance to see all those, both House and Senate versions of education reform bills and education bills. But one of the things that the Virginia Chamber of Commerce came to me about, we are undergoing what's happening with high school, where we're actually redesigning the last 2 years of high school so that we hope that the standards of learning test requirements would be completed by the 10th grade. And then the last 2 years, we would allow students the opportunity in two different ways. If you're in a career and technical track and you are like at K-Tech here in Charlottesville and Albemarle, you may be able to do an apprenticeship in addition to your classes at K-Tech. It may provide you an opportunity for time for an internship or a mentorship, or to take dual enrollment classes at the local community college like PVCC. If you're going to higher education, you know you want to go to college, it'll allow you to take an advanced placement class, additional classes, or again a dual enrollment or dual enrollment classes with the community college, so that you may have as many as is required for many colleges and universities at the state for your freshman year going into college, which will help make it more affordable and allow you to fast-track your higher education. It also would allow those students an opportunity to really also look at, through internships and mentorships, time to find out maybe what they want to major in or what they want their career to be. So, with that change, the state chamber said there's got to be more of a connection with the state board of education and the private sector and the business community. Right now, there's no requirement that at least some of the members of the non-member board of education actually have business experience or be from the private sector. So what this legislation did was just say the governor should select at least two of the non-board members to come from the private sector so that they have that connection, if you will, with the education policy making. And with this high school redesign, I really do believe this is going to be an opportune time to have that connection as they work through those changes and implement that. So with that, let me stop there and listen to my friend Cree, and then we can take your questions.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for giving me the honor to serve in the state senate. Everything you think about, you got to think, put it in perspective. During baseball season, I keep satellite radio in my car so I can listen to the games when I'm on the road. I can listen to the Reds at night. On the way over today, of course, there wasn't a game on, but I was listening to Outlaw Country, Channel 60 on satellite radio. And Bobby Bear, the senior citizen country and western singer, was singing a song about change. Change is inevitable. It's coming. If you were in Virginia in 1940, and I expect maybe one or two of you were, the largest counties, the most populous counties in Virginia, were Pennsylvania, the county around Danville, and Wise, a county between Kentucky and Tennessee. Our economy was natural resources, was coal, tobacco, and manufacturing, textiles. Okay, that was 1940. That was not that long ago, despite what some people might think. Our economy since then has been driven by the military-industrial complex, military federal spending, and that's why you've seen growth in Hampton Roads and Northern Virginia. Okay, with sequestration, which has occurred at the federal level the last 9 or 10 years, and who knows what now at the federal level. Our economy has to be in constant flux. It has to be changed. We have to look for new drivers, new ways to promote growth in different parts of the state. So that's why you heard my friend Steve and Dave talk a lot about the things we're working to do to make in Richmond to make sure that we're prepared for change. Government doesn't always create it, but it can spur it or create an environment that is as conducive for economic growth. What I wanted to spend a couple of minutes talking about, and I look forward to your questions more than anything else, is just talking a little bit about the things that I do, what I've been doing the last few years. I've been chairing this joint subcommittee that's been looking at redesign, and when you talk about redesign the last 2 years of high school, looking at redesigning our network of care providers for mental illness. In Virginia, our system, such as it is a Department of Behavioral Health, which oversees 10 hospitals. We have a huge investment. 50% of the money we spend goes to those 10 hospitals, but they care for just a fraction of those people who get services. And 40 community service boards or 39 community service boards and one behavioral health authority. It all goes back to the early 60s when President Kennedy signed this Community Mental Health Act. And we began the process, which was already taking place at that time, of deinstitutionalization, closing mental institutions. Well, we in Virginia didn't close too many institutions. We have 5 more institutions open than the state of California. We have about 1/5 of the population. They have 5 hospitals. We have 10. We have 40 community service boards, and the community service boards are as different as night from day. You've got Fairfax County, which spends about $100 per resident on mental health, and funds their community service board exorbitantly. And then in far southwest Virginia, you've got one community service board that doesn't have employees. They farm out 100% of their work. So the job that we've been tasked with is trying to figure out a way to basically create a system from this loose confederation of network of providers, this loose network of providers, so that no matter where you are in Virginia, you can receive care when you need it. And we've been working for several years and trying to get our arms around this huge task. It really is. It's like eating an elephant. You take a bite, and it's a big bite, and you can't hold anything else. But you look at what's before you, and you've just scratched the surface. So about a year ago, we enlisted Richard Bonney, who teaches at the law school at UVA. And he helped us put together panels of experts that have helped provide us with some focus. We broke into work groups a year ago, and we accomplished, I'll say, 3 big things, probably a couple other things we can talk about this session. The first thing we did, what we've identified, is that we need people with mental illness need somewhere to go. Do you know that there are about 178, give or take, five or six, 178 people in those 10 hospitals that have been ready to go home for more than 6 months, but they have nowhere to go except the street? You know, and the problem with mental illness, one of the problems, is that people who struggle burn their bridges. They burn their bridges. They have nowhere to go. I was talking to a guy that was probably 72 or 73, 50-year-old schizophrenic son, and his son is on the streets because he can't come back to my house. He's threatened me. He's threatened my wife. He's stolen from us. He's broken into the house. He can't come back. They have a protective order against him. He's on the streets. You know, and the reality is, so many people who struggle, they can't get it figured out. And where do they go? Where do they go? One thing we've identified, and a lot of people have found this, is that you have to provide some long-term supportive housing. So last year, the General Assembly generously put $2.5 million in a pot for long-term supportive housing. This year, they put another $5 million in the pot. The problem is, that's a never-ending pot. We're going to be seeking money every year. We're going to be seeking to add to that pot every single year, but I don't think you can ever put enough in there. That's just a Band-Aid and just a short-term solution. But it's one accomplishment we made this year. A second big thing we did is you know, address a problem that was raised in Portsmouth 2 years ago. A young man named Jermichael Mitchell, about 24 years old, diagnosed with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, well known in the community, shoplifted $5.55 worth of junk food from a 7-Eleven that in his schizophrenic state, he thought the father that he'd never known owned. He was taken to jail, taken to the court. The police officers, everybody involved, they were well aware of this guy. They knew that there were problems. And they faxed an order over to Eastern State Hospital to examine him. The person that got the fax put it in a drawer and forgot about it. 101 days later, Jermichael Mitchell died in the jail in Portsmouth. He died because the food they were providing him, he was not eating. He was smearing it on the walls. He was doing whatever. But 101 days later, he lost a significant amount of weight, like 40% of his body weight, and his heart stopped working. Nobody would take responsibility. Well, we passed legislation and we funded investigators to make sure that somebody gets to the bottom of jail deaths in the future. But again, that just speaks to the fact that we're reinstitutionalizing many of the people that we took out of the mental institutions. 16% of the people in our local jails are mentally ill, seriously mentally ill. 16% of the people in our Department of Corrections and our prisons are mentally ill. 24% of the people in our local jails. We have a significant problem, and that depending on the way you define mental illness, you know, listen to this. 97% of the young people that are in the custody of the Department of Juvenile Justice, 97% either have mental illness or a substance abuse addiction. Big problem. The third thing we did is change the services that the local service providers have to provide. Right now, there are two mandated services. They have to provide a crisis service, and they have to provide case management. And we added to that list 8 more services, but we put it off so that those services don't have to be fully funded and fully done until 2021. Now, in the meantime, but because that's a very expensive list of services, in the meantime, we are doing a deep dive into our local service providers. We're doing a look at this overall structure of this system to figure out how we can do it more efficiently. My view is before we ask the General Assembly and the taxpayers to fully fund a grade A system, we've got to be able to show that we can provide the services as efficiently and effectively as possible. So we're doing that, number one. That's the work going forward. The second thing we're looking at is how can we better deal with this crucial intersection of the criminal justice system and mental health? You know, San Antonio, Texas, I think the eighth largest city in the country, They have 2,300 police officers, and all 2,300 of them have what they call crisis intervention training. The Memphis model is what most people go by. That's a requirement that 25% of your officers have crisis intervention training. Now, we don't all do that. It's not mandated, but that's what most people follow. San Antonio requires all of their officers to have it. They've got a mental health court and wraparound services. They've got a jail diversion program that they think save. I've met with the sheriff. I've met with the judge. They say that they save $10 million a year doing it, diverting people from jail. The CIT training makes officers safer, ensures that there are better confrontations with people when there are they build some de-escalation skills. So we're looking at how can we achieve savings and how can we achieve better results at that end when somebody with a mental illness comes in contact with the criminal justice system, and we're looking at how we can reorganize our system.
Steve, do you or David have any comments you'd like to make before we get to questions? Okay. Virginia Madison, could you help pass out cards also, or John McCauley? While we're getting your cards handed up, I'm going to exercise the moderator's privilege of asking the first question. My questions do not concern a particular substantive issue, but the broad topic of comity within the legislature. In other words, the ability to work together to achieve positive results for our beloved Commonwealth. When Congress is in session, we are constantly bombarded with reports of how the parties can't get together on anything. My questions to each of you are these. How is comity faring in the General Assembly? Give it a grade from A to F. Then tell us whether you think it's getting better or getting worse and why. And finally, tell us what we as citizens can do to help you make the General Assembly more comity-filled and more productive. Who would like to start?
Well, I'm not sure whether you're talking about comedy with an E-D-Y or comity, I-T-Y.
We have more comedy in the House than the
Yeah, that's for sure. I don't think it's getting better. I've been in the General Assembly. My first year was 1992, so I've been through 26 sessions. I went through 10 sessions in the House and 16 now in the Senate, and I'm one of maybe one or two people in the legislature that have been in the minority and the majority on both sides, both the House and the Senate. When I got there, Democrats ruled both the House and the Senate. And now Republicans rule both the House and the Senate. So when I got there, I guess it's always to a certain extent whoever's in the minority is somewhat left out. But when I got there, Democrats and Republicans would argue all day, and you'd go out and you'd eat and drink and laugh and go back the next day to fighting, but you'd get stuff done. And my feeling, my sense was that there was more bipartisan work then, more comity then. I fear what's happened in Richmond to a certain extent now is what I call Washington creep. You have fewer and fewer people who have, grown up in Virginia Your notion of what government is goes back to your fourth grade readings about Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, and there's the 24-hour information cycle now where people get their news. When I was growing up, you got two television stations, 7 and 10, out of Roanoke, where I live, and I don't live far from where I lived then. But then the news came on at in the morning a little bit, and then 6 o'clock and 11 o'clock. But now with information all the time, and my concern is that our comity and is gotten much worse, and I would probably give it a C minus if I were doing grades. What I think can change it might not doesn't necessarily come from people. I think what can change it is if we come up with a better way to draw the district lines, so you can produce a legislature that's more focused on solving problems than on scoring points. And when you have a legislature, when you have a legislator filled with people who have to respond to their districts instead of their base, the districts that are drawn now elect pretty much what they're supposed to elect, Democrat or Republican. I mean, it's all of us, the three of us, are in districts that are drawn to elect pretty much people of the parties that they do elect. And I think if you have a legislature where people have competitive districts, where they have to respond to people from all walks of life, from both sides of the aisle, I guess, you're going to produce a legislature that where partisanship is far less important, and where being able to get along with your the people across the aisle makes a lot more sense.
And what can we do to help create?
I think I've introduced redistricting legislation probably since 2002 or 2003, and I can get it out of the Senate. But I can get it out of the Senate in part because there are a lot of people in the Senate that know they can vote for it and get lots of applaud for it, and they know it'll be killed in the House. They know these guys will take care of it. So I've told the 2021 group that you're involved with, I've told for a while, the way that I really think that you change redistricting is the way that it happened in Iowa in the first place. You file suit. You force that's how you make real change. Baker against Carr changed apportionment in the mid-60s. Brown versus Board of Education desegregated his schools. I mean, yeah, you file suit. You don't wait for the legislature because, people like me, it's difficult, when you've got the power to draw district lines that are going to suit me. If I've got that power, there's a built-in conflict of interest, the way I look at it. And I think that you have to have, it's going to have to be done through litigation, not through the legislature.
Steve?
Well, I'm going to give us a little bit better grade. I think we're at a B. But I do agree with Cree that it has changed since I first started serving in 96, but more importantly, I've seen drastic change in the 28 years I've been there. I've actually served 6 years as a staff person before my service in the House. I think part of the change, and I will say this is true in both parties, that there are outside groups that shove both parties in the extremes. I think we're seeing that. We saw that after President Obama's election with the Republican Party. To be quite frank, I think we're seeing that with the Democratic Party now. And I don't think that's healthy for trying to do exactly what Cree is saying, and that is trying to bring folks together to find common solutions. I think individual members, we can do that, and a lot of us try to do that each and every year. One of the things that I think is incumbent upon those of us that have been there a while is try to set good examples for our colleagues. But I will tell you that Cree and Dave and I are probably the exception to the rule. I actually served in the minority in the House of Delegates, so I understand what that's like. That gives me a different perspective than many of my colleagues who there's basically of the House Republican caucus, there's probably a handful of us that served in the minority. So they have no understanding of, and it's a certain case, they even have no understanding of the rules we put in place to make it fair for the minority from the standpoint of proportional representation on committees and some of those things that we've instituted over the years. And they don't understand why, we would, want to continue those things. But I also think for those of us serving leadership roles as committee chairman or whatever, One of the things you can do is kind of set the example. One of the things that we've tried to do with the Education Committee and then working with actually Senator Newman and then before that Senator Lucas, who chaired the Ed and Health Committee on the Senate side before Senator Newman and the Republicans took control, was to try to work together in a bipartisan manner on issues and at least try to talk. The other thing you can do is when there's an administration that's of opposite party is to have a dialogue. When I'm in Richmond, I have a meeting once a week with Secretary Trent, who's the Secretary of Education, and her staff. So we can talk about what are the issues that the governor's concerned about, what are the things that he's trying to do with education policy, and then where we are, at least from what I hear from the Republicans in the House of Delegates, and then again try to work with Senator Newman. So we've tried to approach it in a bipartisan way. The other thing, as Cree and Terry mentioned, I do think that redistricting can be a lot better than it is now. I'm not, and maybe the courts is the way that it's going to occur if there's a change. The problem I have is I don't want to see the judicial branch interfere, if you will, in a legislative process. Like it or not, a redistricting bill is a legislative process, and it always has been. Even with the Iowa model with an independent commission, a bill has to be put forward to the legislature to vote on. So there's always going to be some influence through the legislative process. And I don't think that's a bad thing in that the Constitution, both at the federal and the state level, have always given people's elected representatives the responsible for redistricting both for Congress and the General Assembly. So I'm of the mindset that we can do a better job. I've had the constitutional amendment this session that wasn't successful to try to depoliticize that process and look at the criteria more objectively. And I think that's the way we should try to go in reforming. But Cree may be exactly right. I think if you look, there may be, you know, the only remedy from the standpoint of forcing the issue may be the courts. But again, I hope the courts will not then, and they have impacted redistricting. You've heard of the Voting Rights Act. Southern states are drastically impacted on what they can and they can't do, to the point where it's provided less flexibility to provide more common districts, I would say, than we've had. The other advent has been computers. And the census is driven by what we call census blocks, and that is where people live. We are never going to be able to tell people where to live or where not to live. So you've also got that. In fact, we were talking at lunch that where there's population shifts, even in Virginia, if you look at congressional districts in the future and even General Assembly districts, and my colleagues know this very well, you're going to see more districts in the urban area, and that's just going to be a fact because that's where the population centers are going to be and have been the last 10 years. So you've got to remember that there's those factors that are beyond the court's control and the legislature's control. And it'd be nice if we could assign people to try to say, hey, let's live out here a little bit more. Then the last thing I want to say, I think one of the things that Cree said was spot on, and that is there are fewer of us that understand what the Virginia way meant and how that meant working together for the common good. And unfortunately, whether it's in the executive branch where we see people that have not, you know, kind of grown up in that Virginia way, or the legislative branch, they just don't understand that. And that's why I think for those of us that are there for a while, it's our job to try to provide an example and to remind them why we do things the certain way that we do to try to work across lines, party lines.
David. Well, both of my colleagues mentioned a lot of very good points. I'll try to amplify on a couple of things. And let me say this, you know, I've been, I think, a Democratic leader since 2011, and so I have thought a lot about that question for a long time. The role of a minority is sometimes to, as they say, throw bombs. But I think you have to be really careful as you throw the bombs because
you can destroy the nature of the institution if you are just obstructionist to the point of absurdity. I mean, and you see it in Washington all the time. I mean, I remember when Mitch McConnell made his very famous comment as soon as Obama got elected that, you know, he basically didn't want to have him succeed and essentially tried to deny him almost everything he wanted to have done. Now, I mean, it's one thing to deny somebody based on a political opposition. It's another thing to just say right off the bat you don't want a person to succeed. I've never tried to do that, and I hope that if I do it, that people will call me on it. It's hard to give us a grade because, you know, when you're sort of in it for a while, you're not necessarily seeing all the changes that are going on around you. I can say a couple things, though. I mean, you know, I get up and down on the floor a lot, and I get up and down with him a lot on the floor, too. But I think that Steve probably understands that while sometimes I may be asking him a gotcha question, I sometimes am asking a real question I want an answer to. And there are a lot of people on his side of the aisle who don't think that. I mean, they think right off the bat. Their antenna is up, saying, Toscano's up there, he's going to try to get me, you know? And I think people have to put that aside. I mean, it's easier for lawyers because they do it all the time. But some people don't understand that that's part of the give and take. You get to the floor, you don't understand something, you ought to ask. If you can ask before, that's great. But sometimes we're having these things coming at us too fast. Now, I think there are probably too many bills introduced, but you can't keep and what that does is it clutters up the committee dockets, and a lot of bills are not ready for prime time, but yet people try to fix them in the committees. That takes a long time, and then they end up tabling the bill. So that means that you don't have off time that you can spend getting to know your colleagues, and it makes it more difficult to discuss with them how to make things happen. I think appropriations has too much power. Appropriation, and why I say that is there are a lot of bills now that go up to appropriations, and they're making the decision about the policy of the bill essentially by deciding whether or not it's going to be in the budget. I think that creates a lot of problems. The thing, you know, redistricting, I think we talked about, I think that does create a problem. The best thing you can do to help us, a couple things. One is you can work for redistricting because I do think that will help the problem. But secondly, watch what we do. Watch what we write. Watch what we say. I write a lot of stuff, and a lot of you in this room probably get it. And if you don't get it, you need to sign up to get it. But if you see me writing something that you think is just unfair or inflammatory, tell me, because I want to know. If you see me give a speech on the floor, and I joke that I've given so many speeches on the floor on Medicaid expansion, I have my own YouTube channel on Medicaid. You call me and say, David, you're out to lunch on this. You know, will you just tone it down a little bit? And I will take, you know, I'll take that into account. So let us know what you're seeing, because sometimes we can't see it. And you have to help us. And call the other people on it, too, if you see them doing something inappropriate.
We had a separate question on redistricting reform, but I think each of these gentlemen is talked about that, so I'll pass over it. Next question, where does Virginia stand on compliance with the Real ID Act, the federal law?
That's a good question.
You know, I do know a little bit about this.
It's funny how your mind works. I got briefed this week by Commissioner Holcomb on this because there is a requirement on the federal law that we do embrace federal ID. And yet there are a lot of people in the General Assembly who do not like that at all. So what the commissioner is trying to devise is a system whereby certain people can indicate that they will opt out, so the state can comply by creating the system by which you get the real ID. But if you go to the DMV and you don't want that special mark on your license, you won't get it. But you will still get an ID, but it won't allow you to access the federal systems in the way you need to. So, for example, if you don't like to fly on planes, you can opt out of the system. You can get your regular ID, but it won't have the real ID mark of distinction that will allow you to get on a plane. So that will be your choice. You know, you'll decide whether you want to be on a plane, and there'll probably be a lawsuit about freedom to travel and all that. But that's the way I think they're working through it, and I think this will come at us in the form of a budgetary item because it's going to cost millions of dollars to do. I think the feds are going to give us some of the money and some we have to put up. But that's my best understanding based on what I just heard the other day.
My understanding is, and what I've heard, is that the budgetary impact, as David said, and so we'll have to see. The governor may include some resources in the budget because the commissioner in the department could ask for additional dollars based on what they're seeing related to that requirement.
But the other thing I might say as well is if we don't comply in some way to that federal law, none of you who have licenses, because you don't have the market distinction, will ever be able to get on a plane. So we're going to have to do something. Is that your understanding?
That's my understanding. Unless the Congress, as they move at their snail's pace, or the current president decide to do something differently, which I don't think they're even talking about it.
So. I don't see how they can do it. Also,
next question. Is Virginia's state retirement fund being properly funded?
We're working toward it.
I think the Virginia, anybody in here who's got any interest in the retirement fund, your dollars are okay. The mistake we made with the retirement system, in my view, I voted against it, was about 5 years ago. We're moving from a defined benefit to a defined contribution state. With VRS, and I think that provides a disincentive for young people who might want to become public school teachers. I think we ought to be about trying to find the best way we can to get the best and brightest minds into our classrooms. And I worry that the retirement system, is not the tool that it once was to do that. That said, I think the retirement system is being funded properly, and I think we have one of the healthiest retirement systems, public retirement systems in the country.
The real challenge, I think the state's trying to do its required part, and we've actually tried to front load that a little bit more because we were behind. We weren't fully funding the rate as the Board of Trustees was requiring the General Assembly to do, or requesting the General Assembly to do. But localities are the ones that are having the real, real tough time. And obviously, for those local employees, teachers, and other local employees that are participating in VRS, it is their job to fund what's actuarially required as their share. And that's a real challenge for a lot of localities. You know, Cree mentioned the two largest counties in 1940, Pennsylvania and Wise. Those are the type of counties that are having a hard time now because there is no coal production as there once was, and tobacco has pretty much gone away for Pennsylvania County, and textiles as well. So that's just an example of some of the challenges that they have at the local level. And their school-age population is dropping, too. So there are some real challenges on the horizon for those localities. And at some point, the state's probably going to have to step in with some of these localities, whether we want to or not.
You know, it's very interesting. This is a very complicated issue, and it gets all bollocksed up in these notions called unfunded liability. If you were to hear that phrase, you would say, okay, if the Virginia retirement says has an unfunded liability of blank percent, you'd be worried. But that isn't necessarily the case. There is a certain level in retirement systems, there's always a level of unfunded liability because you're not paying all the retirees out right now. And so you can project into the future and still live with a little bit of unfunded liability. The other thing is that people don't realize it depends on how much money we put in and how the stock market does. If the stock market is booming, our unfunded liability goes down. If we put more money in, our unfunded liability goes down. But if we don't properly fund it a year, then our liability goes up. That's why every year we have a debate about how much to put in the fund. We have to project. And every year we also try to project what the stock market will do. Long and short of it is, if you're retiring now, I don't think you have to worry very much about benefits. But if you're retiring 20 years from now, because those decisions are made by people in the room at the time, in the Appropriations Committee, they have all that power. And what the stock market is doing, you have an interest in watching out who's in the room and what's happening with the stock market to make sure your investment's protected. So it's not easy, and it's going to be a continuing issue that we're going to have to face.
Next question. What can the state do to improve high-speed internet access? And I might add that one of the best high-speed internet access jurisdictions is Wise County.
It is. Jack Kennedy is the clerk of court down there, and he has made it his mission to put Wise County on the technological edge when it comes to just about everything. High-speed internet, it's like electricity in the 40s or 50s. It is part of one of the necessities of life. You know, but the reality is, you know, out where I grew up, out where I live today, we didn't get electricity until 1941, when the federal government, you know, got us electricity. And some precincts out there didn't get phone service until the 1970s, when co-ops were created to provide them service. Today, you know, it's embarrassing that we, you know, I remember a few years ago we had an issue with one of the big providers. They wanted to force their way through Nelson County to get to Lynchburg. They didn't want to provide any service to anybody in Nelson County at all. And so it's a huge problem. And much of the area that I represent, there are people that don't have service. Now, fortunately, there's some innovative things out there. The rural co-op out in the country where I live, it's Bath Allegheny Rockbridge Cooperative, one of the rural co-ops that was set up in the 1940s under the Rural Electrification Act, is getting into the internet business. They're getting into the high-speed internet business, and they are because nobody else is doing it. Nobody else is providing the service. In some parts of the state, you run into opposition from the private providers. They say, well, we don't want you in competition with us. Well, if you were there, there wouldn't be any need for government to be involved in it. So it's kind of the state, you know, we could adopt a policy, we could invest a ton of money and develop an authority to basically provide service where it isn't. But what we have to do, it seems to me, is create the right incentives so that we can get the private sector, the providers that are already out there, out into the rural areas in particular. There's some deserts and some inner cities where there's not service. But, you know, what that right and incentives, you know, are always green. When you're talking about the big providers, that it's about coming up with money or coming up with financial incentives, it seems to me. But we got a responsibility for doing it.
How many of you actually live in Albemarle County? Whoa! I know one thing you can do if you don't have high speed internet. Now I'm one of those that has a hotspot at home. That's all I can get. I can't get a wire connection in my house, although it's across the road. And if I want to pay $5,000 to bring it across the road, I can then get high-speed wireless. But I've got a pretty good high-speed wireless Wi-Fi. And the problem in Albemarle for many areas is you can't get that because the county does not want to have towers above the tree line. And from a technological standpoint, the problem with that is you can't get the signal. So if you don't mind a tower here or there, or a few more, that is something that could help, at least short term. But Cree's right, long term, to get hardwire, fiber optic cable, that kind of thing, We have a broadband advisory council. They're looking at bringing forward recommendations every year to try to spread, if you will, more opportunity across the state. And it is dollars. That's usually what they recommend, and we've tried to provide funding for that. But again, short-term in Albemarle, if you want wireless connection, the only way to do that is to get the county to back away from and this isn't a partisan thing, because this happened over the watch of many, many years of members of the boards of supervisors. But they won't allow anything to go up above the tree line. Well, if you know anything about signals, you have to go up high enough, or at least in an area where it will be able to go down. And it depends on the topography, too. You know, Albemarle is not a flat county by any means. So you have to have a little bit of an elevation for that to work. So that's one thing that can be done locally. And actually, more and more localities are realizing that you've got to look at options like wireless and the like until the kind of fiber optic network is out there far enough where everybody can access that. But if you don't have hardwired internet access, I'm with you, because I don't either, and I'm not paying $5,000. I'm going to wait.
You know, the question is always, how do you build the last mile, and or the last 30 miles in many cases? We do have this broadband group that's looking at this, and it's hard to know what they're going to come up with. I don't know all that much about how rural electrification occurred, or even how telephone service was dispersed over the last for the last mile. But from what I can understand, there are subsidies that occur, that people in urban areas paid a little bit more on their phone bills in order to help fund the expansion of the utility into the urban areas. That is very difficult to do anymore. The general atmosphere is not like that anymore, where people think, well, I'm okay spending another dollar to help people out in Pennsylvania County get access to internet, but it costs money. So you got to figure out it's either going to cost money in terms of a bill, or it's going to cost money in terms of the private sector investing, and what's the incentive if they're going to build something that costs $5,000 and get $10 back in return every month. So you just have to think of some different models. We had a real controversy, at least in the House this year, about whether localities ought to be able to create their own broadband authorities and build to the last mile. And what really became controversial is overbuild the system so they could compete with the cable companies and essentially get money that could help them fund building the last mile. I don't think this issue is going away, because people need it, but how it's going to be funded, I think is, you know, important. We don't think of cable as or internet as utility, and that's part of why it's developed this way. If we thought of it as a utility that everybody should have, we'd be looking at a different way, I think, of funding it, and the regulators would come in and basically say, okay, you're going to put a little bit more on this person's bill in order to help fund that person doesn't have it right now. And I don't know how that's going to unfold, but we'll wait until the broadband group reports back.
Actually, if you look at your cell phone bill or your landline bill, there is a deduction for these funds still.
There is, and we have a higher communications tax than most states, but we still have a huge gaps. In the internet is essential to life anymore. If you're going to compete in the 21st century economy, you have to have access. You have to have the highest speed possible, and we've got a responsibility to develop the network, and it hadn't been done yet.
Next, what's the status of medical marijuana legislation?
We passed legislation a few years ago to allow opioid. And open, I can't pronounce this, but whatever you call it, the liquefied. Yeah, we passed legislation to allow its use for certain epileptic conditions. a few years ago, but we didn't pass legislation to make it legal to possess that or to manufacture it in Virginia. So we basically passed legislation that we knew would need more legislation. We passed that this year to allow the creation of, I think, a compounding pharmacy, but we're taking baby steps on the medical marijuana journey, and that's probably what we can do now. We also passed the bill to require a study. I think that we are taking a hard look at legalization on a broader scale for marijuana. Did I miss anything there?
You know, every once in a while you get a bill that makes you realize why you do this job. And this is one of those bills because, you know, I know that you two were probably also visited by young people who are, you know, they have epilepsy at a young age and they're having 6, 8, 10, 12 seizures a day and their parents are going crazy. And this bill that allowed them to use those oils really has changed their lives. And that's when you pass a bill like that, that makes you feel so great about the fact that you put up with all the other stuff you have to put up with, and you really can help some people. Now, there was a bill, I think, and maybe it was in the House this time, that would have allowed the use for cancer, pain related to cancer, as long as it was prescribed by a physician. I think there was another disease that it could be used for. Those things were stripped out. I think it's probably coming. Virginia is a little bit behind the curve on some of these things, but I think it's coming. I think people realize that there are ways you can control this so that you don't make it available to the public as a whole, and you can help some people's lives.
I don't know if I'm correct about this, but there's so many bills and so many votes, but it occurs to me that we passed a broader bill in the Senate and you killed it in the House Courts of Justice Committee. Is that right?
That probably would have been the case.
Yeah.
But medical marijuana is now being taken up for study in the Crime Commission. And Delegate Bell is chair of the Crime Commission, so he's not here. But we're going to tell you to contact Delegate Bell if you think this is a good idea. So that's what he gets for not being here today.
And let me say, I think there's support for the evidence-based usage of marijuana for medical purposes. But make no mistake, there's not support for recreational use and having people drive under the influence, all that kind of thing. So I think sometimes the argument, at least those opposed to even medical the medical use, are trying to say we're going to expand it so that everybody can get it for whatever purpose, like other states, and we're just not going to do that. But I think David's right. I think there's building support for the medical usage of marijuana for certain cases, and I think that, you know, be interesting to see what the study comes back with. But that's the information, I think, and the direction we're heading.
One final question. As president of a property owners association, I'm distressed at the number of continuing restrictions and hurdles that the Virginia legislature has passed. The most frustrating is the constraint passed a couple of years ago on the ability of a board to impose penalties on owners for violations. Who keeps pushing anti-homeowners association legislation? And what can we do to repeal the worst provisions?
It's the members of the delegation from Northern Virginia. That's where most of that legislation comes from. And for those of us that aren't on the committee that deals with this, it is mind-boggling when they argue about this on the floor. And they have homeowners associations that have a lot of control and a lot of power in neighborhoods in Northern Virginia, and it is very controversial, but that's where most of that's coming from. I think a lot of us would be fine with the homeowners associations that we have in the areas that we represent because they're reasonable. They don't do, you know, those things that are just not common sense and try to be kind of dictatorial. It's more collaborative, and the board of directors are actually representative of the homeowners. In Northern Virginia, it's like they have campaigns for boards of directors for homeowners association, and they're pitted against each other all the time. And then they also come up with policies that just are ludicrous sometimes in Northern Virginia that take away. I mean, you've heard the stories of you can't fly an American flag on your house. You know, it's just things like that where they become so onus that we get all this legislation. So I think that's where the majority of those things come from.
And I used to be on the General Laws Committee in the Senate. I can confirm everything Steve said. It's like not necessarily a partisan issue, but the Northern Virginia delegates and senators they war on this issue all the time. They're anti housing association or homeowners association groups, and they're pro homeowners association groups, and they fight the battles out, and everybody else just kind of, you know, just watches the action. And at the end of the day, you've got to try to figure the issues out, yeah. and decide what you will, but. That's where this battle is being fought. And up there, they are all homeowners associations. All the Henrico or Fairfax and Prince William and Loudoun counties are just about 100% homeowners associations.
You know, it's funny you say that about what goes on around here. My law partner actually has a practice in this area, and I have watched this over the last 10 years. His practice gets bigger and bigger and bigger because there are more and more disputes. And I don't know if that's a function of the legislature. I'm not on any of those committees, so I don't watch the fights go on. Usually when a bill gets to us that's related to homeowners associations, unless it has to do with putting solar panels on your house, it's not controversial, and it just passes through. But, yeah, there are a lot of problems. I mean, some of these things are bigger than little cities. And they have incredible power.
That concludes our session for today. Please join me in thanking our speakers.
Thank you.
Cree, Steve, and David.